They're dancing on their grave. Like, we didn't actually implement that. It was just sort of the character felt really happy in spite of, But we're like, we really need to add that to the game because that's amazing. They should, query how they felt about the person who died, and if they, really are delighted by them being dead, well, why not?
This is Up Up Down Down, or potentially a highly convincing simulation of Up Up Down Down. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also thrilled to welcome David Baumgart, our director of Gaslamp Games. David did the delightful artwork in Gaslamp's hit game Dungeons of Dreadmore, is now neck-deep in the development of Gaslamp's highly anticipated Clockwork Empires. Hi, David.
Hello.
So our topic for today is simulations. Why they're hard, what makes them fun, what makes them not fun, and the trials and tribulations of trying to make a game with simulations in them, and all the consequences thereof. I think a good place to start, since David is neck-deep in Clockwork Empires, which is a very game I'm really excited about, and hearing everything from GDC, the world is very excited about all the really awesome and fascinating and bizarre simulations in Clockwork. I think a really great way to start would be, David, to tell us a little about Clockwork Empires and sort of what its deal is and how it relates to simulations and what's going on.
Sure. I should be good at this. Last week at GDC,
you spent an entire week doing this.
Yeah, just giving the pitch over and over. All right. So, Clockwork Empires is a sort of colony builder game set in a bizarro version of the 19th century British Empire. The player is sort of the invisible hand of the bureaucracy running a colony for the Empire, and you're thrown into the darkness of the frontier with a pile of supplies and 20 colonists, and then you give them jobs, and hopefully they're together enough to carry out those jobs in a meaningful way so that you can ensure their survival and prosperity.
So the game is in some ways a builder type sim game, but there's also a lot of simulation going on under the hood as far as like the economy and all that kind of stuff of the colony that you're building.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything sort of comes back down to how the characters feel about it. Like, if they're unhappy, they'll, spend more time wallowing in misery or drinking whiskey and not really carrying out the player's orders. But we hope to make that sort of character failing an interesting story in itself. I mean, then it also rolls into that, how they carry out your economy, and then it, higher and higher levels of complexity there.
So there's this idea that characters sort of wallow in their misery and maybe like ignore you. Or just, they want to drink instead of build the thing they're told to build, which is like one of these ideas is like somebody who works on games, that's really hilarious and fascinating. And someone who hears about it, that's hilarious and fascinating. How do you balance as a player when you tell, you have your players, they tell them like, oh, go harvest this fungus. And instead he just like goes and gets drunk and falls asleep. That's funny the first time. How do you balance those sort of things where this is maybe what the simulation says should happen, but this is what the player wants to happen, and kind of towing that line?
Yeah, that's definitely a conflict that is a huge problem at the core of what we want to figure out. I think the way we can get around, we don't want the player to mind control the characters, because then they're not really characters. They're not interesting. They don't have their own little personalities and, wills. And I think what it comes down to is expressing why the character isn't carrying it out and making that interesting, and sort of giving the player a warning that it's going to be a problem before it's actually a big problem. And then after it becomes a problem, in a way, it's the player's fault for allowing it to happen. So they
right, which is when simulation is working well, if the player can actually see what the problems are and why.
Yeah.
And so an example, I think, from, I don't remember if it was you were writing about it or Rock, Paper, Shotgun, which had like a wonderfully glowing review. It was very cool that I'll put in the show notes. They said something like, what if Peter Molyneux's bullshit that he was always saying would be in games actually were in a game? That's what Clockwork Empires was.
Or perhaps, what if Dwarf Fortress were actually playable?
Yeah, I mean, one possibly cheap comparison is with Dreadmoor, we're making a roguelike successful. In one limited sense, with Clockwork Empires, we're making Dwarf Fortress accessible. But we don't really want to pitch it like that, because there's a lot more to it, and we're doing some different stuff. But, you know.
But that's, I think, when people are first, at least that when I first heard about what you guys were doing, that's a lot of what got me initially excited as somebody who loves hearing the stories about Dwarf Fortress. It's like, oh, wow, that's so cool that there's this entire evolution of someone who, you know, has built this fortress underground that has this such a complex and sort of emergent gameplay that they can tell a story that's thousands of words long of just the story of their colony and the insane things that happened that is entirely emergent through just how complex the game is, as opposed to necessarily this is a story that was written by someone who thinks that it would be an interesting story.
Yeah, that's absolutely at the core of what we want to enable players to do. So that's a great way of summing it up. I mean, the Peter Molyneux crack, I believe that guy believes what he's saying. I guess he doesn't follow through exactly. But
I think it's not even that Peter Molyneux doesn't follow through. It's just that his plans are always beyond what the technology can accomplish at the time he's making them, right? That he,
yeah,
you know, he has good ideas and he realizes some of those ideas, but he has more good ideas than it's possible to realize either, like I said, given technological limitations or given actual development schedules.
So what do you guys, this is something I wanted to talk about in particular. When you think of simulations, one of the things I think of is Spore, which is a game that when you hear, it's like, we're going to simulate everything. And you're like, really? Everything? Like, all the way down to cellular level? Yes. Okay, what about space? Yes, we're going to simulate everything. And you're like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. And then you actually play it and you're like, right. So they only have a finite amount of time to work on the game. So it's all kind of like simulated sort of boringly, but everything's there. Or, you know what I mean? Like, so that trade-off of, how do you strike that balance in game design and development when, whether you're a AAA team with hundreds of millions of dollars or you're a small studio that's just like trying to eat, how do you strike that balance of how much do we simulate? How much of the game do we tackle that's going to actually be dynamic as opposed to just say, like, you're not taking on, okay, well, this is going to simulate a colony anywhere in the world. You're saying, okay, well, it's going to be in this sort of like 19th century British feel, and we're not going to try and just like tackle all any potential other theme, you know, for example, right? And in some ways, it's those things that you decide to not do and the things that you lock down that make a bigger effect on the game, in my opinion, than the things that you're like, okay, well, anything can happen. Well, then probably it's not going to be very understandable.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Although I think we've been... I think we've been extremely ambitious, which I think a lot of people enjoy about the project, but it's a bit nerve-wracking. I would even say something like Spore, I would want... Okay, so we're extremely ambitious as an indie company. We can afford to think we can do that. I would wonder if Spore, due to necessarily being a AAA development... I think they might have had the simulation, but someone high up didn't believe in it. They didn't trust that the game could be built on that, which is unfortunate. I think with Clockwork Empires, we're betting on it for sure.
Yeah, but you're betting on one specific part of that puzzle, right? Like, you're not simulating...
Oh, everything.
The DNA splitting in the people.
Yeah, that's just crazy. I think maybe it could have worked, but...
Those kind of multi-level simulations... I think Spore is a really interesting example of failure because it's failed in a way that no other simulation game, at least that I can think of, has failed of trying to simulate all these different levels at the same time. And most simulation games at least are only trying to simulate one world, right? They're just saying this is the environment that we're simulating, and all of the new elements that we add in are going to feed into that simulation. I basically didn't play Spore at all. Like, I was sort of excited about it when it was announced and followed it, and then when the reviews started coming out, I was just like, this isn't worth checking out. So you know, you can take my opinions on it with a bit of a grain of salt because I haven't actually played it, but everything that it sounds like, the what it is it's actually just four different simulations, none of which are like a whole game. They're all just kind of simulations of a little piece of it, and then eventually you move up to the next level. And so instead of making one good game and putting all their effort into that, they made like four adequate games and strung them together. And that's, yeah. I mean, that's a really bad way to make a simulation game. When simulations get interesting is when the depth and the emergent behavior really take on a life of their own, and you're not going to get that if you're building four games in parallel.
I would say with Spore, they didn't even build the game on the simulation in the four, or I forget how many levels, four or five. I did play through it once, and it seemed that they had some simulation to populate content, but it boiled down to a series of mini-games you'd play to collect pieces, and when you collected all the pieces, you advanced to the next level. So they didn't even build the gameplay on the simulation, which is, that was highly disappointing, because I think someone wanted to go with a much more conservative approach to how to build a known game. So it was sort of contradicting the traditional Maxis game, where you have this wonderful world and all these moving pieces, and you sort of poke it and see what happens. But here it was more like you hit the sequence of buttons and collect the thing in advance, and just all the amazing, like, it's really amazing technology, the procedural animation generation and all the little 3D construction kits, like amazing, you know, user interface design, but none of it actually meant anything to the game itself.
Like, right, as opposed to something like SimCity, where you actually have these emergent problems in your city where you're like, oh, great, okay, so I've made these policies that cause a lot of industry to come in, but now I have all this pollution, and it's not like some rule that says if you make this policy, therefore you get pollution. It's just that I put a low tax on industry, and so a lot of industry moves in, and then now I have a lot of pollution.
Sure,
and it's now like I have a problem.
Consequences to decisions, which is really what a good simulation game should be about, right?
Right, and I think the thing that makes it fun for people who love, and I love that type of game, is that they're sort of indirect consequences. It's not just, oh, I'm going to pick the have industry and get pollution strategy. It's just, I want industry. And then you're like, okay, well, here's a side effect of that. Now what do I do? And the fact that there's, and you had a quote that I thought was really interesting about choices, about if you have a problem in a game that the players have one obvious way that they can solve it, that there's just the best way to do that, it's just a puzzle of, okay, well, figuring out, should I do this or should I, oh, actually the right way to do this is to shoot that guy and then jump over there. Okay, now I win the level. As opposed to if you have a series of interesting choices, then it's something that you can play again and again and again. And every time you make the choice, you get a different gameplay, and that's the actual fun part. It's the making the choices and seeing what the consequences of them are.
Yeah, and it's not even something as simple as I'm going to go to like Mass Effect, where you choose, you know, good, evil, neutral, or something. It's not even like the choices are a sort of natural and organic part of the simulation itself, right? So it's not simply branching paths. It's poking the simulation and having it react.
Yeah, which is the only practical way, really. Like, we always say we want options in games, and we want the ability to make choices. And when you think about the branching paths in something like Mass Effect, like, you have this exponential explosion in possible outcomes if you just let people just say, you know what, the whole game is built around getting missions from the king of the world, but as soon as you meet him, you're like, I shoot him in the head. It's like, okay, well, all the content we prepared is now completely irrelevant, right? So instead you have to force people down a path. And the simulation type of game is the sort of main way that I know of to provide like kind of an arbitrary number of choices without having to write like 100 million lines of dialogue.
One of the things that good story-driven simulations do is they have a couple of sort of archetypal paths that you can pick. You know, if you look at something like Deus Ex is a good example of this, of they'll usually have both the original and Human Revolution. They'll usually have a couple of different paths sort of major paths. Like, okay, you have a, you can just fight your way in, and you have a, you can stealth your way in, and you have a, you can hack stuff. And then also based on your particular character customization, you're going to be able to exploit the world in different ways along those paths, but still kind of, you know, there's a major choice you have to make, but it feels less phony because also within each major choice, there's these different minor choices that you can make on the world in, at the world simulation level that don't make it feel like you're just pushing a button of like, oh, I'm going to take this route. And in Deus Ex, one of the sort of famous elements of it is that the final moral choice is just kind of a push button thing. In Human Revolution, ridiculously so, right? That like
literally push a button.
You just go into a room and there's like four buttons you can push to get the four endings.
The destroy the world button and the save everyone button.
And Deus Ex kind of falls down in that way right at the end. Even the original Deus Ex, which handles that final moral choice a lot better, it still is just kind of like, all right, you figure out what the path you're supposed to follow for each one of those is, and you sort of redeem your actions for the ending. But up until those endings and that kind of forced moral choice, games like that, that even if they don't go to the level of just like, oh, we're going to set up a completely simulated world, trying to flavor the story game with simulation elements of saying, all right, you know, build a couple of routes, but there's no one right route, and every player is going to be able to find their own take on that route, can make for really nice story-driven games that use some of the same concepts that more complete simulations, more stuff like the Maxis Sim whatever games do.
Yeah, and I'll say when designing, you know, content for Clockwork Empires, we sit down and are like, you know, we can break player archetypes down, you know, people who love combat, people who love building, people who love decorating, people who love, you know, starting cults and summoning horrible creatures. And we're sort of like planning out these paths and trying to populate content into each of them. And what's really cool, I think, is seeing how someone who, you know, skirts between two paths, say, and how like their content interacts with, you know, a bit of content from building interacts with summoning terrible demons or something. It's like you get these sort of organic and weird contradictory elements, which I think is really cool to see.
So you get a user who's really into the demons and the designing a cool town, but then he's really upset that the demons come and destroy his town. He's like, hey, what's going on? That's not what I wanted.
Okay, actually, we kind of planned for building and summoning things, but I'm sure there are ones we haven't thought of, and it's really cool to see those.
What's interesting, though, is there's always that trade-off, and for some background, I built a few, couple simulation games when I was in university, and they were sort of web-based games, not as much, not like full things like The Sims. One was a politics, like you be a politician, and you can sort of try to assassinate your opponents and scandalize them and things like this. And the second one was a build your own religion one, which amazingly, I never heard of it offending anyone, but that sounds like the most potentially offensive, non-politically correct thing. But both of those suffered, especially the religion one, from this idea that by having every sort of path available, it allowed people to choose paths that weren't fun, which is kind of sad because I'm like, oh, hey, look, you can make any kind of religion in the world. And it's like, oh, okay, make a religion like this. It's like, well, everyone converts away your religion and it dies. And I don't know, like it seemed frustrating to me. And it was frustrating to me that by, you know, making all these options available, it necessarily meant that most of the options you could pick were not necessarily fun. And I guess for either of you, I'm sure you both have opinions on that. Like, how do you deal with that as a game designer?
Boy, not fun options. We try to make everything interesting, no matter what you get up to, even if it's terrible failure, which is sort of turning into a thing we're pushing as part of Clockwork Empire. It's like, and Dwarf Fortress, to take that model, is when you know, your dwarves go kind of, they get really upset, they go a little mad, they start jumping off cliffs or throwing things. Like, it's really bad in terms of accomplishing game goals, but it's also really interesting and kind of funny to share with your friends.
Yeah, and that sounds great to me.
I mean, hopefully, we're just trying to build the content so that nothing is just, you know, boring. And we can tip the numbers a bit so that things will tend toward instability.
One of the other dangers with that sort of thing, with having the options, is the players finding a way to not have fun, but that's also very successful, right? That's the biggest trap in any heavily simulated game, is you're just going to get that possibility that there's some strategy that you haven't foreseen that is going to allow people to exploit the game and do way better than they should be allowed to. And oftentimes those techniques also aren't fun. Like, at least if the things that are not fun are sort of particular play styles, but, you know, you can tweak your play style a little bit and do something slightly different and it'll be more fun. You know, that's something that we talked about this in another episode, this sort of idea that players have to be somewhat responsible for their own fun with the game, right? That you can't bully them into having fun. If people are gonna say, like, hey, I did this thing that was really annoying and I was annoyed by it when I did it, like, at some point you just gotta let that go.
Yeah, but you have to take into account that if like a good strategy, maybe not even the best strategy, but the best strategy that a player finds is not very fun, like, especially if it's not so heinously boring that they're like, okay, obviously this is just broken, but something where it's like, well, they find out that, like, yeah, okay, there's 23 different things that you can mine, but actually the best thing to mine is copper, and just only mine copper and only make things around copper, and the rest of the game actually is not as, you know, rewarding to trying to, quote unquote, beat the game.
It's hard to see those sometimes at the design level. It's hard to know which techniques are going to prove to be dominant, and there are genres of games that handle that well. Like, fighting games are sort of famous for having a wide variety of characters, sometimes with very different abilities, and the designers spend huge amounts of time on those, just polishing those interactions and trying to make sure that every technique that you discover that seems like it's just so sick that it's dominant, that there's some other character who can counter it in some unusual way. But a fighting game's a way more restricted playground, right? You've got a fairly simple set of mechanics, and you can do that sort of brute force, like, try all the possibilities and try all the weird little edge cases and think about the problem space enough to realize where things are going to interact weird. Once you get into these more complicated simulation games, you can't always do that. You can't always know where those weird edge casey techniques are gonna come from and catch those things at the design phase. And you run that risk of creating some dominant strategy that's not fun anymore.
Absolutely. We're doing play testing to try to find that. Like, back in Dreadmore, we actually just rounded up a bunch of people from random forums and said, like, here's a free game, you know, go for it, try to break it. Just, you know, make us feel terrible. And they did. One guy would, every time we did a iteration, we'd patch the beta, and then he would be like, okay, I'm going to beat your game in, like, you know, an hour. And he just kept doing it, and it's like, okay, just tell us what you did, and we'll try to, you know, balance for that. I think the only way we could possibly account for such things is, like, just lots of iteration, playtesting, and, you know, after release, just trying to react to what players come up with. And they will come up with everything.
That's kind of the fun of it, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in a way, it's like a meta game that, you know, we play with the players.
Yeah, yeah. When I had my politics game, there was one point where somebody found a bug that you could, with a certain technique, you could assassinate other politicians really, really cheaply. And instead of reporting this to me via email or something like this, he decided to assassinate every other person in the game 15 times each. Because what will happen if you get assassinated is, like, so-and-so junior will pick up. So if you're, like, you know, Hero Man Jr. and then Hero Man the Third and then Hero Man the Fourth, and it would, so like every single dialogue and every single person in the game is like Hero Man or so and so the 27th, and they're all at like, you know, 0.01 reputation because they are completely irrelevant, and then we can tell who did the assassinations because they're winning the game. And that's just the kind of thing that, you know, in a multiplayer game, that matters a lot. Like, that was a big problem. People were upset about that. But in a game like Clockwork or Dreadmoor, you're really only affecting yourself. And that's a lot of the thing I love about that category of game. I mean, I think a better example than something like Deus Ex is something like the Bethesda games, where, like, for Fallout or Skyrim, that because it's just you in the game, you can go into the town that has, I don't know, the best sword maker in the entire game, and you can kill him. And then you can't get any more awesome swords, and then that's your fault because you suck. Like, and that's sort of, you can allow that sort of thing in a game that allows for many possibilities, where in a multiplayer game, of course you can't allow that, because then everyone else will be upset and you're ruining it for everyone. And the fact of that feeling of being able to sort of actually have control over the game, as opposed to, you know, for good or for worse, means that your consequences have, or your actions have more consequences. And that's what one of the things I really like about that kind of game.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad I'm not having to deal with that problem, or, you know, with multiplayer and, what do you call it? Just sort of, not exactly static content, but, you know, sort of global content, like an MMO or something, or something as strictly balanced as a esports type game.
Yeah, there's a lot of negative consequences on game design, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole fascinating world, but it has to be a lot more restrained. Like, you know, with these more single player or just play with some of your friends type games, you can really just go a little crazy, and it's more fun when you go a little crazy, like with the consequences of actions, because, I don't know, it's great.
I think in a lot of single player games, where the simulation mindset helps isn't so much in having those consequences, because you can't deviate from the story too much without creating this crazy branching path of dialogue. But what you can do in a single player game is create these really interesting different approaches that people can take. Like, that's what I like about games like Deus Ex or the Thief series or the System Shock series, is they're all very conventional story-driven games where you go from point A to point B and there's a couple of branching paths here and there, but they're constrained. But what makes them borderline simulation games for me, as opposed to a more conventional FPS, is that you have these set of rules about the world that you're just kind of left to exploit, right? That there's not necessarily this is the path you have to take, these are the things you have to do, you have to find this key and then put it in this door. You know, even if it's not literally finding a key and putting it in a door, it's sort of conceptually that, is they just say, here's a scenario, figure it out, you know? Dishonored is another great example of that recently, the game that I'd put in that, like, story-driven, but clearly it's got one foot in the simulation world, right? It's not a Sims game, but it's got a way more of a sense of there are rules to how the world operates, and how you are successful at the game is by figuring out interesting ways to use those rules to accomplish things.
Like that moment-to-moment sort of the gameplay, that's where the simulation really comes into it.
And something like Dishonored or Deus Ex or any of those, I can totally imagine, like, playing through those completely differently. You know, those are games that I go back to. I haven't played Dishonored again yet, though I'd certainly like to, but Deus Ex, the original Deus Ex, I played through several times, taking totally different approaches. The Thief games, again, haven't played the latest one yet, but the earlier ones, all of them, I retried all the levels multiple times with different approaches. That's not something that I would do with, like, Call of Duty. Call of Duty, like, I like it, but it's, you know, pop it in, play through it once, enjoy it, and then put it on the shelf and never touch it again. Like, there's no point in replaying single-player game in Call of Duty in some sense, because it's, you know, it's always going to be the same thing. There's never going to be any significant changes in gameplay. Even when there are branching paths in the story, that there can be differences in what happens in the cutscenes, the gameplay is just the same thing, and that's, you know, that doesn't give you that replayability.
Speaking of replayability, I was totally going to have a good intro for the sponsor that segued from what you were going to say, but I couldn't think of one. I wasn't fast enough. This week's show is brought to you by Cube Drone. Cube Drone is the world's leading webcomic and video series about code. Friend of the show, Curtis Lassom, has been producing Cube Drone strips since 2008, but has recently invented a patented brand of shorts on software development. Each video tackles a development topic in 60 to 90 seconds in a way that's both educational and sarcastic. So thanks to Cube Drone for your hefty financial contribution to the show.
Did Curtis buy you a beer? Was that the hefty financial contribution?
It was actually two beers. That was the agreed. If anybody would like to sponsor Up, Up, Down, Down, though, it is a hefty financial contribution. You're ruining the drama of it. So something I think is interesting, and maybe it's an interesting topic, or maybe it's just a thing that grinds my gears, is this business in simulation games, and especially SimCity, which is a game I grew up with and love very much, where you'll see this business of, okay, in a small city, they're simulating these details. So you have like three buildings, and if you zoom in, you look at like, oh, they're okay. There's people walking from building to building, and this guy's holding a briefcase because he's an upper class sim. Oh, that's pretty cool. And then you get to like 1,000 sims and 10,000 sims. And because every single sim interacts with every other sim, and every single car might get into a traffic jam with every other car in the city, the whole thing just starts to grind to a halt. And even if you have like a pretty beefy computer, once it gets to the, like, you have a large city, like, I mean, I'm interested in simulating Vancouver or Chicago or New York, right? And it's just not even remotely capable of doing that, even on a computer that's like comes out a few years after the game comes out, because they have these like n squared algorithms, meaning like everything has to interact with every other thing, that are cool at small scale, but then when it gets big, the whole thing just implodes. And so the way that they dealt with this in the new SimCity is like, oh, okay, well, we kind of realize this is a problem, so you just can't make a big city. It's just that you only have this tiny plot of land. And that made me really sad. And I guess, I don't know if that's like a, hey, like, do you guys know of any solutions to like not have that problem? Like, I mean, fundamentally, if you have an algorithm that everything interacts with every other thing, then there's a very, very hard limit on how big your simulation can get. But I guess it's more sort of like, how do you make that trade-off of the things that are interesting and when this place is really little, when your simulation is really little, not causing total disaster when things get huge.
Well,
how you can deal with it is how Spore dealt with it, which is just have multiple different simulations and totally fail at the different levels, right?
I want to hear David's actually good suggestion about how to solve it.
No, yeah, we've got this. So for Clockwork Empires, we actually have a Micah J. Best, who is doing his PhD thesis on like massively parallel things, systems.
You have my attention.
Hey, I think I know him.
You probably do.
He used to work at Radical.
Yeah.
I know him.
Cool.
Yeah, so we've got him, and basically there's this whole ridiculous amount of infrastructure into the technology behind simulation in Clockwork Empires, with message passing, and I'm going to wave my hands here because I'm the art director, not the technical director.
Even better. You can make promises then about how it'll perform.
Oh, yeah. And they'll feel compelled to carry through. But basically, in CE, you can throw as many cores at it as you want, and you'll keep getting improvements. Or improvements in performance. So our problem is not so much, we can throw like 300 characters in, have them all be feeling and talking and doing silly things, but our problem is actually a design problem now. It's how many characters can we meaningfully express to the player, and how many can they keep track of?
Right, that's really interesting, because then you have this circumstance where the technology has opened up your ability to have an unreasonable number of things going on.
Yeah. And I mean, we are indeed abstracting a lot of stuff. We're not doing any kind of like physics simulation or like really low level stuff. But I mean, the data is essentially on the level of Dwarf Fortress, and the rendering sort of tries to keep up as best as it can, which is usually pretty good and good enough most of the time, almost all the time.
So what is, I mean, obviously the game's it's kind of like in a pre-alpha or alpha-ish state now, so you don't necessarily have an answer to this, but what's your thinking on the consequences of giving and putting this focus on what an individual character feels? Like, this guy is jealous today, but if there's 300 people in your town, like, how many people can you have in the town when you the player basically just can't care about any individual?
When the player can't care anymore, that's an unfortunate place to be. We're really trying to do this by feel, like we're trying to test what this is going to look like. So I don't have a great answer there, except like trying to appeal to empirical reacting to the to what you know our testing shows.
I mean, there's a couple. I mean, just going from prior knowledge, there's a couple of things you can think of. One is this unit of like people can generally, from user experience, people can think of kind of like 8 to 12 things at once, just kind of like at the top of their mind. And then there's the Dunbar number of like you can kind of have a sense of 150 people in a group. And those are the two numbers that come to mind.
Yeah, we've been sort of thinking about where is it between those two. Like I do recall in Dwarf Fortress, like your first 7 dwarves, like that's they're easy to pay attention to. But then after that, they become a blur. And I mean, a way we're trying to address part of that is with this notion of a cast of characters, as in like the characters in the game, which you actually pay attention to, as opposed to the ones that are sort of just do their work and add to the flavor.
I like that. So they would be like sort of your hero characters.
Yeah, and we do that by exploiting the Victorian class system. So in a sort of Dickensian sense, the lower class characters are less important, and they are literally less important. But of course, you can pay attention to one if you want. But we focus the player's attention more on the middle-class characters who are directly taking on the player's orders. So they're naturally, as part of the mechanics, what the player is interested in.
So you could have like a factory owner who then tells the sub-factory people or the peasants or whatever what to actually do or whatever. And so his actions matter more than whether or not some guy digging a ditch digs it left and right versus up and down. Or
yeah, like we actually have the personalities of these overseer characters with laborers assigned to them, like affect laborers, how they perform. So, you know, a sort of brutal manager will, you know, get more work out of their workers, but they'll be more unhappy, and a sort of laid back one will, you know, they'll be happier, but less work is done. That sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's actually like you sort of, when I asked, how do you deal with this problem of having too many people that you can't care with, your initial reaction is, well, we don't really know yet, but that's actually a really good answer. Like have a system where there's characters in the simulation that the individual characters matter more, and then you can care about them, and then you actually attach to them.
I was thinking like after our class system, then, you know, at what point do we hit? But
yeah, for sure. You should definitely have the ability for there to be like this one peasant that you really like get attached to, and the game notices that you keep checking in on Oliver and, you know, hope that he gets adopted or whatever. And then it sort of notices, it's like, oh, they seem to care about Oliver, so maybe we'll give him more interesting things or make him more likely to be promoted to, I don't know, end up being an aristocrat or something.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys played like the Crusader Kings 2.
No.
But, oh, well, just ridiculous number of characters. It's like all the noble families in medieval Europe, and you are a particular one, or you're really kind of role-playing as a dynasty of them, which is, it has this whole fascinating like medieval soap opera feel, but there's so many characters that it could be like the medieval soap opera 747 cockpit, just overwhelming information. But you know, you could tag a character you're interested in and you'll get like extra alerts about that, and I think we'll probably try to take an approach like that.
I think it would be cool to do that, but like without the player entirely realizing that it's explicit, like without it being explicit, like
that would be cool.
I've decided I care about this person, which is sort of a tacit, like it's an implicit from the player admitting to themselves, I can't possibly care about all the things that are being thrown at me and I'm going to ignore them, as opposed to the game being like, well, I've seen you clicked on this person more than most other people or whatever, you know, then it's kind of like, oh, okay, well, then you probably are interested in him. And obviously you know, if they're visually distinctive, like one peasant is one of the few peasants that actually wears pink, and then you sort of notice him and you click on him, and then like the game doesn't need to know why you're clicking on him, but it knows.
That's a good one. Yeah, we should put in the credits.
I was going to be a little careful about stuff like that, that any time there's mechanics like that that are hidden in that way, you've got that potential for false positives, right? Of like, you just happened to click on that guy 4 times because he was performing some task that you were sort of interested in because you were waiting for it to complete, or just because you were tapping around randomly, and then all of a sudden that guy's become really important for no reason. I mean, maybe in this sort of environment that doesn't matter as much, because it doesn't matter who the important characters are as long as they're, you know, as long as it's telegraphed to the user in some way who they are. But
I think that's sort of
great,
though.
It's got that potential for bad training of the AI if you if you're taking input in and it's changing the simulation, but in ways that isn't obvious. You know, you kind of want the user to always have that notion of understanding what actions they're taking. That I think that's a key piece of what makes a successful simulation. To badmouth Peter Molyneux a little more, the last game of his that I played much of was Black and White, and it suffered from that pretty badly, of both the your Titan character and your humans and stuff like that. Like, you never really understood how the things you were doing were affecting them.
Even though the simulation itself had really good reason why, if you told the Titan, like, oh, do this thing, and then you punished it, but it had just started doing some other thing, then
yeah,
as far as it knew, it was being punished. I mean, just like animals, especially, you know, like people try to train dogs and stuff like that, and the dog will do something bad in the morning, and then you get home, and then you're mad at it, and the dog doesn't know why you're mad at it. It's just like, I did 27 things since then, and so it learns badly, and this Titan in Black and White is doing exactly the same thing, but it's not fun, nor is it fun to mistrain your dog by accident, right?
Yeah, but so, at least in video games, like, you can log some data from the dog. Like, you can say, oh, yes, the dog thinks that I punished it because of this. Yeah, you don't have that advantage in real life, but also, you know, in real life, we're not trying to make training your dog into an entertaining game that people are going to want to do for fun. In video games, you are, like, you want people to be enjoying the thing they're doing. And that's why things like the emotion thought bubbles and stuff like that, even though they're very gamey concepts, and it'd be like, oh yeah, it'd be really cool if, you know, if everything just kind of happened and we didn't have to care about that stuff. In practice, yeah, something like Black and White shows why that's a problem, is that if the simulation, even if the simulation's good, I mean, maybe the simulation was really good and really interesting, and I was training my Titan to do all sorts of things in very realistic ways, I never really felt like I understood what was happening with the Titan.
You have to make things pretty explicit to the player, or like they can very well associate all kinds of things with what the Titan character is doing. Or we had a problem with that, actually, where we had this, you know, cute idea that you needed to hire a phrenologist to examine your character's skulls to see what their personality traits were, but then we realized if you start the game and you have no phrenologist, then you don't know why the characters do anything. So yeah,
and even if you do get a phrenologist, like, what you're doing is adding a level of making it more difficult to figure out why things are happening.
Yeah.
And anytime you make it so that the player makes an action and then they're not sure what the consequences of that action are, it's not fun, right? Like, and this is the same thing, back to that build your own religion game, where I would make it so you could make some laws, like, oh, okay, now everyone has to be naked. It's like, okay, so you made that law, but now, like, your religion is kind of sucking, but you don't. Is that because I just made that law 5 minutes ago? Is it not obvious entirely? And because it's a religion, it's something that happens over thousands of years, I didn't feel like making a new rule in your religion should immediately take effect, which sounded realistic, but it was actually a bad decision, because then people make these decisions and they don't actually know what's going on.
Yeah, if you're going to define simulation as you did earlier, I think it's a good definition, is the key thing that differentiates a simulation from other kind of games is you have this sense of all of your actions have these permanent ongoing consequences that change the underlying world and the underlying context of what's going on in the game way more significantly than they do in like a story-driven game or a puzzle kind of game. But the caveat to that is if you don't understand what actions you're taking that have consequences and what those consequences are, it's going to feel at best like some toy that you're playing with, not a game where you're trying to accomplish goal. It's just like, all right, well, I'm doing some stuff and things are happening, and I guess this is kind of interesting to watch, but I don't feel like I'm controlling it. Or at worst, it's, I don't understand what's going on here. I don't know why I'm doing any of this stuff or what's happening or why all my guys are dying or whatever.
Yeah, going back to Thief, I remember the little light indicator to show whether you're in shadow or not. Like, making that super explicit and super important was, I think, a great decision, because, I mean, in other games that purported to have this, hiding in shadows, like, you were never sure if, like, the game was being buggy or if they actually saw you or what was going on.
Yeah, the light gem's fantastic that way. It's a completely non-realistic, gamey sort of thing, but it gives you that very clear handle on what the simulation of this world is. How much you're in light and shadow is what determines how people can see you. And you've got this very clear indicator. And yeah, there's a simulation, a very complicated simulation going on of like, what are the guards' vision and how much are you hidden in various places based on the real lighting that's available in the world. But you've got that thing to grab onto of, here's my thing that tells me where I am in that problem space. And playing something like Thief would be quite frustrating without having that light gem, because you'd always have to be guessing, like, oh, am I really, like, I look like I'm standing on a shadow, but maybe this is a shadow that's being cast by a different light and I don't know. And
this is a controversial thing, right? Like, games in one sense are trying to provide immersion, and this idea that you just sort of are in this world and you're sort of absorbing it and you're not thinking about it as a game, and that's directly opposed to this idea of making it really obvious, like, hey, by the way, this enemy can see you right now. And that's, like, you know, so many stealth games have sort of realized that they're better off if they inform you. Like Assassin's Creed will have a little boop, like it actually makes a noise if someone notices you, which obviously, and even a really great assassin does not get that obvious of a notification that somebody has seen you, but not fully noticed you, but they're just starting to notice you. Like, that's obviously ridiculous, but it just makes the game better. And that sort of game designed realization that revealing more things to the player and just giving them explicit information is good is something that took me along. Like, I was sort of quite against that and generally scoffed at, like, oh, it's just sort of dumbing it down and breaking my immersion. But I think Dreadmore had, what, 24 stats on your character or more?
Yeah, too many. But
Sagacity was one of them.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I must admit, I never actually did figure out what sagaciousness, I mean, it's like magic related, but is that, like, it's not a made-up word, I assume.
Yeah, no, that's that's a real word. It's, you know, how sagely you are, how knowledge.
Oh, like how much you are like a sage.
Yeah, so it sort of works out like that.
Yeah, okay. But that business of, like, you, the first time you open it up and you're like, oh my god, I have 24 stats. What the heck's going on? Like, why are they showing me all this? But when you actually start digging into the game and you realize how much, in some ways, it's a similar theme to Clockwork Empire, is that there's lots of little things that can happen in this game, and some of the fun of it is the unexpectedness of all the little, the quirky things that can happen, items you can get, or occupations that people can have and things like that. You need to surface the consequences of these things, and just hiding it all and just be like, well, this guy starved to death, so good luck figuring out why. Like, that's just not fun.
Yeah, I do regret making all the icons, like, just 16 by 16 pixels, because that was awful, but Oh, actually, very early on in Dreadmoor, there is this Nicholas, our technical guy, had this idea that there shouldn't be numbers. It was going to be one of those like naturalistic sort of experiences, but it was terrible. Like, you know, you sort of show that you're hitting the enemy, but you don't really know what's going on or if it even, you know, picked it up or if you did any damage, if you did a lot of damage or a little damage. And like, so we added back in the damage numbers and suddenly like everyone loved the game way more. And it was way more fun because, you know, you're interfacing with the simulation basically, and you're getting really good and immediate feedback. And it just goes back to all that. Like, the player has to know that they're actually affecting the game.
And that's really counterintuitive because it seems like eventually it starts to feel like at least as a designer looking at the screen, it's like, this looks like a spreadsheet, right? Like, I got 24 numbers, and actually I'm looking at a screenshot of your stats in Dreadmoor. There's actually more than that. It's your main 24, and then there's a number of other ones. But like, if you don't show those, then it's this guessing game that's just, you have no idea what's going on. And that feedback loop of, I made a decision and things got a little bit better. The tighter that you make that, the more compelling your actions are going to be. You're going to positively reinforce things because you knew you did something. And even if you don't feel like enemies are dying faster, you knew that your burliness was 14 and now your burliness is 15. And that's presumably good.
Yeah, people, I mean, it's a little artificial, but people do like watching numbers get higher, which, all right.
I think that the goals of simulation and the goals of immersion are somewhat in opposition that way, right? That if you, it's hard to get immersed in a simulation in the same way that you can get immersed in a story or a puzzle-driven game. I mean, puzzle games are an example of something where you can go really minimalist on interface, right? You look at something like Eco, which is the classic, like, no HUD. I don't think there's anything on screen other than the 3D view of the world, other than when you press the start button. Like, but it can get away with it because there's no stats, there's no numbers, there's no simulation going on. Everything that's happening in the world is what your character is doing, basically, in that moment. There's nothing behind the scenes that you need to telegraph or indicate in any way. And it's a very immersive game in that respect, but it's a game with no choice and no permanent consequences. It is just, there's a single path through the game, and in each room, you just got to figure out what you're supposed to do in that room, given your knowledge of how the puzzles in the game work, right?
And yeah, if they have, like, the pieces of the game are those just big puzzle pieces that are shown entirely within the rendering of the game, then that totally works, right?
But it couldn't work for a simulation, or or if you tried to do it for simulation, it would be extremely frustrating.
Unless you're going for something else, yeah, that would be bad.
Actually, even thinking about it now, I can think of some examples where you could maybe make something like that work if you were dealing with a very physical simulation, right? If you were just saying, we're going to have a simulation game that where the fundamental simulation mechanics is like, you know, solid body physics or something like that, something that's very tactile, maybe you could get away with it. Like, maybe there's something out there. I don't know. I'm trying to imagine what that game would be like, but...
Well, the nice thing about physics in a simulation game is that we already understand it, and so you don't need to display much about what's going on when an object falls on another object and the bottom object breaks, right? It's not like, what? It broke. Like, what's going on? I don't understand the simulation, right? So with physics is an exceptionally unusual case. Compared to even something like building a city, which we understand the basics of, but very few people out there have actually built a city as opposed to interacted with physics.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of stuff going on behind the scenes in a city that you're just never aware of, right? You'll walk by some street corner, you know, every day on your way to work, and then the one morning there'll be like the crew out there with the you know, with the manhole cover open, and you can see there's like a whole thing underneath the intersection that you never even imagined was there before, with all sorts of stuff in it, right? Like, there's huge amounts of things going on behind the scenes in our understanding of how things work.
Yeah, well, the SimCity seemed to accidentally have left out that part where they dig up a road and then fill it in and then dig it up and then fill it in, like, multiple times a day for weeks. I mean, at least that's what they do in Gastown. I'm not sure if that's in all cities, but that seems to be one of the features that were enabled when they were building Gastown. So I was wondering, David, whether or not you had, and I'm sure you do, but I'm curious about stories of things that you never intended to build into Clockwork that came up and were either delightful or disturbing side effects of this simulation.
Well, let's see. A lot of them are fairly low level. I mean, right now we're trying to hook up all this sort of, like, the framework on which all of these stories play out. So making sure that, you know, for instance, cabbage grows, that's really important. And then once you do that, then you can see, okay, then how people feel about this and so on. But
specifically, yeah, cabbage is very important.
Well, any crops. But I did have a case where I said cabbage, you know, too low, and just my whole colony filled up with cabbage, and there's cabbage everywhere, and everyone's holding cabbage and eating cabbage, and it's just...
That's
terrible.
Kind of great, actually.
Yeah. Another time I was trying to get tree respawning to work, but I missed some logical operation, and they just kept growing and growing. And then these lumberjacks were in this field of saplings that just kept expanding, and then the trees grew up around them, and they were stuck. And
they couldn't get out of the field.
Yeah, presumably they would die if I hadn't ended it.
That's awesome. I was listening to another podcast called Low Earth Orbit, and they were reviewing a simulation game about a space station simulator. It wasn't called DS9. It was called like SB9 or something. It's obviously referring to Star Trek DS9. And there's this problem where if people were running out of oxygen because there wasn't enough life support, they would start panicking. But you would tell someone, like tell an engineer to build some more life support, but they would start building it, and then they would panic because there wasn't enough air, and so they wouldn't successfully complete the life support on time. And I thought that was not fun for the player, but definitely one of those interesting, like, as a game designer, you're like, oh, maybe there's more priorities than just, like, the thing I was told to do and then panicking.
Yeah, I remember in The Sims, you know, something gets set on fire and they're busy freaking out about something being on fire and not calling the fire department.
So right, they're too busy freaking out.
Yeah, which is not helpful and pretty frustrating, but...
Yeah, but it sounds like you guys have a more sophisticated system for that.
Yeah, that's the idea, anyway. I mean, and even then, we want the game to allow people to freak out because of fire and then die, and then the game still go on and deal with the consequences of that, because that could be interesting.
A lot more interesting than in The Sims, when you have two people in your house and then one of them dies and you're like, well, that's kind of...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, here we want people to die. We want the... And then, you know, to have the bodies have to be buried, and then the people have to think about how they felt about the person when they're on the grave. Oh, that was one of the things when we're showing press at GDC, like, just instantly... someone buried a corpse in a graveyard, and so there's a grave there, the person's standing there, and then they do a little dance, and I was like, what? Like, they're dancing on the grave. Like, we didn't actually implement that. It was just sort of the character felt really happy in spite of, you know, but we're like, we really need to add that to the game, because that's amazing. They should, you know, query how they felt about the person who died, and if they, you know, really are delighted by them being dead, well, why not?
So that's awesome. And that's the kind of thing you only get from actually playing the game and getting feedback and experiencing things. So you guys are thinking about, and I'm not sure if this is like an official announcement or just an I picked up, I don't think it'll be scandalous, about doing like an early release, like not waiting until, okay, this is, everything is done and then ship, but like do one of these sort of allowing access to the game and feedback early on.
Yeah, one of the early access type things. Yes, we're doing that. I've been well trained by PR, so I could be like, oh, spring 2014, we'll be announcing things soon. And yeah, that's what I could say about that.
Yeah, no, I wasn't trying to fish for but more just sort of, that seems particularly suitable for a game where I could imagine it never being quote unquote done, because it's so much about, okay, there's basically infinite things that can happen. So it's done when I guess we get sick of like adding even more things and tweaking the consequences of them.
It could easily go on forever, but I mean, there is a reasonable point. And I mean, it goes back to our approach with Dreadmore is, I mean, we had no budget then. And so we just gave the game away and said, please play this. Tell us what you think. And it worked out really, really well for the quality of the game. Because, you know, roguelike has all these procedural things going on. And we, while working on the game, can't, you know, play through it a bunch and see how all these systems interact, especially on, like, you know, level 10. And same deal with Clockwork Empires. But, you know, we've got a little more... it's going to necessarily be bigger and more complex. And, it'll be very valuable. And some people enjoy that. I mean, some people don't like early access and they shouldn't buy it because that's not what they're looking for. But we of course, want to, you know, give people something fun. But it will be something that they could probably easily break. And we also want the player's experience to inform how we flesh out the game. So we can build content in reaction to what works well for players. And I think players will be better off for that. And, I mean, of course, in fixing all the things they find terribly annoying. But it's a way to... It gives them a bit of a voice in the ongoing development, I guess. Which is a neat thing to allow people to do.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty new phenomenon, right? Like, historically, you just... studio spits out a game and it's like, all right, it's done, and people are like, well, it's kind of boring, and they're like, well, I guess the studio's done now, and they go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's like kind of a very
I wouldn't say it's quite that bad. I mean, most games are focus tested to some degree. I think the thing that's changed is that now the focus testing is done in public, right? That up until a few years ago, it was okay, you pull some people in off the streets periodically and make them sign an NDA and make them play it in your office and sit there and watch them. Whereas now it's just like, put it out there, see what people think, see what they like, see what they don't like. Don't worry about the positive or negative press that's going to accumulate based on what we've got. I think that's what's changed more than like not play testing it at all before, and now people are starting to play test them.
Yeah, I mean, this public alpha thing does have some. It can be a marketing advantage, you know, assuming it goes well. But at the same time, there are some very significant games where it went terribly wrong. But I think it's because the makers of the game probably went into it a little dishonestly or with different goals or something weird there.
No, I think for Clockwork, it's a good fit because, you know, you guys obviously are listening to the community, and just from showing press, and, you know, game press tends to be pretty critical, and you're showing them this early version of the game and they're getting excited by it. And that means probably players who fans can be more forgiving than critics. I expect they're getting excited about it too.
Particularly if the core of your fan base is people who like Dwarf Fortress, then
expectations are low.
They're not gonna be creeped out by a game that's somewhat unfinished. Like,
yeah,
Dwarf Fortress has been in that state for what, like 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I do have kind of mixed feelings about some aspects of it, but I think it actually does fit, and I think, you know, if we didn't worry about what people thought or what value we were giving to people, then we might be the wrong people to be doing a thing like that. But, you know, it's definitely a concern, and we don't want to be like, you know, those guys who screwed the customer. And, you know, we all want to deliver an experience with it that is at least, you know, interesting and fun. So I think it'll work out.
I think it'll work out too. I think that's a show. Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes or subscribe at upup.fm or follow us on Twitter at upupshow.
So although, you know, we're not normally a gaming news podcast, I think we have to address the huge story in gaming right now, which is that apparently Duke Nukem is still relevant because Gearbox is being sued by people that have purchased the Duke. I don't even know what the hell's going on there.
I can't believe they're still fighting over this, but just facepalm.
I actually was not familiar with this other than, like, I knew that there was a lawsuit, but what's the details? So what are they suing about? Is it just, like, splitting up the money, or is it, like, who owns the IP someone's making?
Yeah, I think it's mainly really about who owns the IP, that I guess as part of taking over development, like, Gearbox bought all the IP from 3D Realms, but then maybe they also sold something to somebody else, and there's some question about did they sell it all to Gearbox, or was, you know, have they held some of it back, or did they sell it to Gearbox but some of their agreements to release existing things that were in development? I can't even really care about it. I just think it's kind of funny that it's still. Like, that's still a thing. Like, I assumed that between Duke Nukem Forever finally getting released and 3D Realms completely imploding, that we were done. Like, that we could say, like, we've reached the end of Duke Nukem. Like, we know, you know, we know how everything turns out. We know who gets tossed into the Lake of Fire and who gets on the boat to the Grey Havens, and, like, it was done. But apparently not.
I forget exactly how it goes, but Duke Nukem will not go quietly into that night or something.
I think that, you know, if we're going to jump into topical gaming topics, so that the bigger question that I think everyone is asking themselves right now and this week is whether or not Facebook's acquisition of Oculus is going to affect Gaslamp Games' plans to have an Oculus Rift version of Clockwork Empires.
I mean, actually, Daniel, our studio director / CEO / backup programmer / guy who does an amazing moonwalk, he loves this, like, Oculus thing. I don't think the rest of us are. No, actually, some of the artists are really into it. He's been following it closely, and I don't even know what to think. He's like, all the jokes are made within an hour.
And then this the entire thing's done. All the jokes have been.
Yeah. I don't want to spoil anything, but April 1st is coming up, so we probably have a very important announcement to make.
I always consider, I mean, of course, as a sort of like fixed perspective 2.5D camera game, A Clockwork Empires is perfect for an Oculus.
That would be, I don't know how it handles like orthographic projection.
That would be absolutely terrible. Like a strategy game and on the Rift,
what you want to do is you want to put the player walking in the streets amongst all of the people, and then try and find, I hear we're getting attacked somewhere, and then try and figure out where, and then like assign people to defend the attack. We should also get a first person StarCraft. I think that would be good too.
That would be nerve-wracking. But maybe that's the point.
Like, you play an SCV and you're gathering minerals.
No, I've said before in our like offline discussions about this stuff, the perfect thing for VR games is stuff where you're sitting in a cockpit, right? Like that's the sweet spot for that. Like the new Elite game that they're doing that's got an Oculus Rift version, like that's the sort of thing where I look at that and I'm like, yeah, that's going to be awesome. Like a space flight simulator, cuz you just like build yourself a chair that looks like the chair you're sitting in and like put your joystick in the same position that it is in the cockpit, and then you're like there, you know.
That's pretty good because it's like it's a controlled environment,
yeah,
for being represented in VR, like as opposed to walking up to a wall and like looking at the texture looking terrible.
Yeah, even like first person shooters, I'm not 100% convinced that, like, I'm sure they'll be fine, I'm sure they'll figure out the sort of control issues, but anything where you're sitting inside a vehicle is just going to be incredible. Like racing games, space games, flight sims, like those are going to be absolutely astounding on something like that.
Michael Abresh of Valve, obviously, maybe not obviously, if anyone has not seen his talks or his writing on Oculus and other VR stuff, it's definitely worth spending some time on because it's really fascinating stuff. And he has a talk that he gives about the limits of VR and all of the sort of trade-offs that they cause. And one of the really interesting things to me was that he said that most of the, or a lot of the art and UI decisions that we make in game development now doesn't really work very well. So like really lush detailed environments that might look great on a console or on a PC look fake and cardboardy in VR. And some really simple things that look kind of almost trivial on a flat screen look really engaging and fascinating and cool in VR. Which that the idea that when you have a technology that makes new things make sense and old things not make sense means that the things that really, really are great for VR, we probably have no idea yet.
But maybe Zuckerberg has an idea.
Oh, no. And actually, sort of a thing that happened with Clockwork Empires is, okay, well, we hired a bunch of artists who were, they went to the Capilano program. And they're sort of used to the idea of working on, movie graphics or first-person type shooters, like high detail, models and stuff, like, the traditional stuff you'd expect. But we're doing like this orthographic. I don't think it's technically isometric, but okay. So it's got like a very peculiar projection, and there's not really a sense of depth, and we have a lot of smaller and simpler pieces, and like, as an art director going through trying to retrain these guys to think about things in a different way. I'm like, when you're making a model, you have to have an orthographic camera up because it's going to look way different than you think. Just like lots of weird stuff like that. But we're sort of harkening back to like a very old style of game as opposed to VR, which is.
That's something that's not very obvious. A player wouldn't necessarily think about, but I was reading your blog posts about doing the art and putting things into the game, specifically about pickled fungus, which I can link up. But the little art for the crates of jelly that you turned into crates of pickled fungus for the people to harvest and create in the game, those assets, just as an example, look great orthographically. And I look at this image, and it's like, okay, well, it has a really satisfying geometric feel. And especially when you lay them out on a palette because you're laying out all these resources you've gathered flatly. But then you have below it an example of it just sort of in your 3D modeler program. And it doesn't look as good because the camera is just slightly different. And it doesn't have that having it be in a cubic crate, it doesn't have that same satisfying feel. So I think being aware of that art style probably makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I'll admit that that image of it's actually in the game object importer is totally messed up and actually the wrong ratio, and the lighting got changed and no one fixed the camera, and so it's actually doing a great deal of disservice anyway. But that's a good thought.
I think the crates look good in the game.
Oh yeah, the thing that came up in my mind when we're talking about something was the idea of like an ICO or something, like what is in front of you and obvious versus like what is more abstract, like numbers in the background. We don't actually have like a money number in Clockwork Empires. Like, you have X dollars, because what I wanted to do was represent the wealth and prosperity of your colony, like in the objects in the colony itself, which is, sort of attempting to do a naturalistic thing. We do have a UI element you could pull up to see, exactly how many logs you have as a number. But I really wanted it to be conveyed in what you see in the world, and it to be something visceral like that, as much as possible anyway.
I noticed that in the video, the PC Gamer had a video and then in the screenshots. But my gut would be that you'll probably cave and actually have a number up on the HUD somewhere.
We sort of caved. There's a prestige points with it's basically money, yeah. But a little more loose in narrative terms, so we can do kind of silly things. But it's a good thought though.
Yeah, and that's something, like we said before, always it's appealing, the idea of just showing you, like, it's this narrative thing, show, don't tell. Like, don't tell me how healthy I am, just, like, show me how healthy I am. But this business of, like, okay, well, your screen gets, like, bloody, and, like, I don't know why there's so much blood on your eyeball, but you're, you know, like, it doesn't actually make the game better. It's just, like, give me a little meter that shows how not dead I am.